11. Cliff listened to the deep rolling music of the Sil Dirge. This was an honor, he realized, to witness the public mourning of these lithe aliens, their voices soaring in a long, rolling symphony he could understand, at least emotionally. It was truly so. Music had fundamentals common here. Their flowing melodic line had tricky interior cadences, sub-themes, and as it gathered force, these merged to become a high, howling remorse laced through with beautiful, somber notes. In the carved rock amphitheater, the Sil stood as they sang, sat when they did not, their angular heads lifted up to show faces twisted with grief. They had lost many in the assault by the remorseless, hydrogen-fueled sky beasts. Those vast creatures had killed so many Sil, almost as an afterthought, punishment for hiding humans. Apparently firing into crowds was permissible, and the Sil seemed unsurprised by these events. Cliff sat and thought of that as the music wrapped around him. It immersed them all. He could see this strong music had its effects on those beside him. The Sil had many subtle eye gestures, and the odd elongation of the flesh around the eyes apparently meant mourning. All because of the humans. His small band had been on the run for a long time, and now had met the sobering fact that those folk who ran this huge spinning machine would kill others just to stop a few humans. But why were they important? It puzzled him, and gave the slow, solemn proceedings of public mourning a gravitas he respected. Their song rose and fell, their long bass notes reverberating from elaborately carved walls. The Sil leader, Quirt, stood tall and splayed arms to the sky as the large wind instruments among them, not separated as in a human orchestra, joined in the deep notes, pealing forth as the longer wavelengths resonated with those reflecting from the walled basin. It was eerie and moving, and Cliff let himself be drawn into it. Grief made its same choices for the Sil as among humans, gliding, graceful themes, deepening as the growing amplitude plowed into more somber courses. Then suddenly that ended in a stunning trill the voices held for a long while as their instruments boomed forth. The silence. No applause. Just grief. They all, Howard, Irma, Terry, and Davy, sat respectfully until told to move, as they had learned was considered polite here. Howard was nursing a bad cut and a bum knee. Terry and Abby had burns and bound-up wounds, but altogether the humans had minimal damage. They kept their heads down, perhaps from politeness, but Cliff lowered his eyes because he did not want to look into the eyes of the Sil more than he had to. The Sil filed out, their slanted faces seeming even longer now, no one speaking. Their instruments caught Cliff's eye. The laws of physics set design constraints for woodwinds and stringed players— long tubes, resonant cavities, holes for tuning. But the music that bloomed from these oddly shaped chambers and strings was both eerie and yet familiar. It had an artful use of counterpoint, moments of harmonic convergence, repeating details of melodic lines. There were side commentaries in other keys, too. Was music somehow universal? As they emerged from the stone bowl, he looked back at the now empty crescents where the seats each had a slight rounded depression for sitting. Once, in Sicily, he had seen an ancient open theater that looked much like this. But here the stones were pale conglomerate, not limestone, and far older. Yet the same design emerged. Still obeying the code of silence, they walked into the sprawling community. This part of the Sil cityscape had escaped the firebombing. It was a vast relief to be away from the charred precincts where he and the others had worked for, he could not even recall the count. At least a week, though now it seemed a boundary between a past where he had felt in control of his world and now this. He pulled his mind away from the memories. Focus. His crew training made this possible, but not easy. The Sil chose habitats, he noticed, the way a seasoned soldier instinctively chooses cover. Here a wall gave an angled exposure to the star. Another wall stood oblique to that, to allow the jet's glow to have its say with redder luminosities, so each shadow had different colors at play. One wall gave protection from the prevailing wind, with an apartment perched to take advantage of the cooler prospect, big open windows facing away from the field of bright, fine sands that bounded the Sill town. There was a lake nearby, not deep, but enough to fetch a tranquil blue from the hovering sky. Sills lounged in shadows for delicious rest, on a spongy plain, their bodies prone on the soft jade green. Sill crowds gathered there, their trilling speech low and reflective. A moist breeze blew through the crowd, and streamers of fog danced among the zigzag trees. All eyes followed the humans. They had all agreed to affect a casual disregard of this.
"Think of it as like being a movie star," Irma had said.
And it was. The Sill at least hid their sliding gaze by turning heads a bit away, but Cliff felt the pressure of their regard.
"They wonder what to make of us," Howard whispered.
Abe said, "We're enough like them. Two arms, two legs, one head. Maybe that's an optimal smart alien design. Makes us sort of simpatico. Better than the bird folk, anyway."
"And the Sill know to keep a distance, give us some room to take them in, too," Terry added. "It's kind of fun. Here are real smart aliens who aren't chasing us."
"Or killing us," Irma said sardonically. "Beth's team wasn't so lucky."
This memory sobered them as they passed by a truly ancient-looking stone edifice. Erect on its bare site, the huge blocks sweating with every gush of mists from the lowlands. Cliff savored the moist breath. The winds here stirred with minds of their own, sinewy and musical as they hummed through the Sill streets. The homes somehow generated music from the wind, hollow woodwind notes in lilting harmonies that seemed to spill from the shifting air. The sky was clear, a flight of huge lenticular clouds sliding past like a parade of ivory spaceships. The sky creature had been of that size, moving with ponderous poise, beautiful in its way and lethal. These clouds poured rain onto distant hills, and the fragrant breeze brought the flavor to them. As they often did, the humans watched the strange landscapes around them and tried to figure out how it all worked. Abe and Terry maintained that there had to be tubes moving water around the bowl, since otherwise all fluids would end up in the low-grav regions near the poles. Irma pointed out that some photos of the bowl, taken when Sunseeker was approaching, showed just what Abe and Terry thought. Huge pipes running along the outside of the bowl. Cliff listened to all this and sorted through his photographs. He had nearly filled his calm camera's digital storage with photos of plants and animals and had to edit out some to free up space. Already he had decided to ignore algae, bacteria, protoctista, fungi, and much else. He kept snaps of purple-skinned animals loping on stick legs across a sandy plain. He had captured flapping, flying carpets with big yellow eyes, massive ruddy blobs moving like boulders on tracks of slime, spindly trees that walked, birds like big-eyed blue fish. A library of alien life. Cliff knew he had missed a lot of creatures because they had quick and good camouflage to conceal themselves. They discovered this by stepping on what looked like limbs or lichen or dirt and turned out to be small animals that knew the arts of disguise. He sucked in the moist air and recalled that on Earth, desert plants defended against losing moisture by keeping their stomata closed in the day. They opened at night to take in carbon dioxide without evaporating too much water away. On the bowl, though, without night, the air had to hold enough moisture to let plants respire, venting oxygen. That meant a lot of water. It explained the heavy rainstorms and thick, flavored air, the sprawling rivers they had to work around, the mists that shrouded even small depressions in the land. Yet some aspects here were like an Earth that had vanished long ago. Standing nearby was an enormous version of something he had seen Earthside, embedded in coal beds. Horsetails. These resembled a first draft of bamboo, thick-walled, segmented grass, tan and tall. The trunks popped as they swayed in the wind, eternally fighting for space and sun and soil, just as did all the others. He had seen creatures that excreted through pores in their feet. Surely not from Earth. Their speech sounded like whistling and farting at the same time. Both used flowing gases through a pinched exit, but... Quirt broke off from a murmuring crowd. Moving with efficient grace, it came up to them, its big yellow eyes heavily lidded, and said,
thank delivered in kind. We now speak, want.
Its language ability came in simple stutters of words. Cliff could usually guess the content. Quirt moved with rippling muscles. Like brilliant gazelles, Cliff thought. The Sill were limber, dexterous creatures that worked on the bowl's understructure. They lived in small towns, mostly, so this now ruined city was unusual. Quirt said Sill were peppered through the immense lands of the bowl. They seldom met other Sill groups larger than the few thousand here, since distance isolated them. They received instructions from the folk and carried out their labors. Otherwise, they governed themselves. Populations were stable by social conventions, handed down for countless generations. This was a standard folk method, apparently. Divide and rule, Cliff thought. Throngs of Sill followed their mourning with festival. The humans stood aside as the lithe forms began to move, sway, sing. All around them spontaneous movement broke out. The warm sun and lancing jet stung their skins, and they danced until a kind of glow spread on their skins.
Maybe the exercise changes their surface circulation? Irma wondered, as the pumping music swelled, bodies glided and kicked, and the golden richness of Sill's skins seemed to give off its own moist radiance.
Quirt led them to a low building, its walls slanted sheets of ivory rock. Beneath their feet was blonde gravel that, as they entered a small room, turned green, each pebble wrapped in a translucent skin of slime. Quirt bent and carefully unhinged from some sculpted seats small blobs that seemed to be slugs that had adhered. They sat, and the seats adjusted their bodies with a slithery grace. There was a long wait, but as protocol required, the alien spoke first.
We need no goal, astronomers.
They want to catch us, Terry said, or kill us.
Whichever is easier, A.B. added.
Capture best for them. Folk want know what you know,
Quirt said this flatly.
About what? Irma asked.
Ship you ride, plants you carry, bodies you have, songs. Possible is.
The swift, slippery slide of Quirt's words belied a calm the feline alien wore like a mantle. Plainly, Quirt was a leader. The talk went on, speculating on why the folk had fired into a Sill crowd. Yes, humans were among them, but why did that matter? Cliff watched the alien and reflected on what could come next. In his experience, people centered their lives around money or status or community or service to some cause, but the Sill seemed to live learning-centered lives. Here, little bits of practical knowledge were the daily currency. Howard had given them a Mobius strip to amuse the children, and their main vocation was to be preoccupied with some existing little project or maybe a dozen. As one Sill had told him, it was quicker to list the jobs he didn't hold than the ones he did. There were teams completing a pit to turn manure into electricity, plans to build a micro-hydroelectric generator in a local stream. They devised and built their own lathes and saws, tough enough to carve into the hard wood of the big trees that ringed their sprawling village. The Sill seemed shaped by what Cliff saw as a frontier-like culture. Here they drilled into trees to make body lotion, or designed cement hives for swarming insects, as if to foil a creature that sounded to Cliff like honey badgers. They're isolated, Cliff thought. No other Sill for great distances, or other intelligent species. Out here in the bush, lost in their experiments. His attention had wandered. A.B. had been peppering Quirt with questions, and nobody understood its answers. Then the alien leaned back, yawned to show big teeth, and held up its hands.
Not right thing you speak for. Folk want all adopted to obey. I, we, you,
a liquid pointing gesture,
not made in bowl. Danger, badness comes from us, say folk.
This came out as hard, clipped words, not the sliding sibilance Quirt usually used. It was tricky inferring emotions from alien facial signatures, Cliff's judgment warned him, but the narrowing eyes and tensed lips made a constricted face that oozed resentment. Cliff said, "You came before us." A quick blinking which seemed to convey agreement among the Sill.
"Not adopted over long time. We move, live, work. Folk give us things. We do their commands.
Irma said, You said earlier that you move often?
Quirt looked puzzled, as it always did, by the human habit of conveying a question by a rising note at the end of a sentence.
Our kind rove.
But you have buildings?
Young must learn by doing. This we know, costs to know, must pay. No such thing as free education, and buildings, cities, used to talk.
Talk?
Adopted can see our work from everywhere in the bowl. We shape our cities to make messages, small messages, big shapes for streets, parks, buildings. When we know, they know too. What folk want from you.
The Sill had a way of leading you toward what they meant, then letting you go the rest of the way, maddening at times. Asking them again or in a different way got nowhere, banging on a door that wouldn't open. The Sill preferred to show them. Quirt took them to a site where the ground seethed with a tan, stretching substance. It came out of the bowl when the Sill triggered it, Quirt said. Then they tuned it somehow. Cliff inspected one of their handheld devices but could make nothing of the ribbed and fissured face of it. The Sill apparently took in information and gave instructions by feel, not visually. This seemed odd for ones who had so many eye moves to express themselves. Cliff was still wondering at this when the slick tan surface began to ease upward. It became grainy as it rose, wedges emerging from the big bubble that blossomed above them. It firmed up into walls and crossbeams as windows opened like sleepy eyes along the edge. A thick, cloying scent, like drying cement, filled the air, and Cliff stepped back with the others, not able to follow the complex moves the constructors, as Quirt termed them, made to shape the thing, through signals he could not fathom. After an hour or two, a fresh building stood 2 stories tall. The floors were rough, and there was no clue how the inhabitants could get water or electricity, but the oval curves of its walls and sloping floors of the interior were elegantly simple. The roof sported an odd array of sculptures that imitated Sill body shapes and cups pointed at the horizon. In the entire growth of the home, Cliff felt a tension between order, as seen in the room gridiron pattern, and a spontaneous, discontinuous rhythm to the wrinkled walls and oblong windows. It had just enough strangeness to be expressive, though he did not know what the Sill made of it. They seemed to think it played a role in reconciling them to their lost friends and shattered city. Nomadic, Cliff guessed. Each generation set up shop in a new area, hunted and gathered, devised their own kind of town. A species with a wandering curiosity, alighting on interesting parts of their environment. The bowl was big enough to accommodate that style. But buildings as messages? Did the bird folk read your building messages?
Think not.
Quirt made a rustling sound in its big chest and said quietly,
We lost many. Sill, like you, many parts, all lost.
There was a sadness in the long, sliding words. The self-forming buildings seemed to play a role in their reconciling what had happened. Yet none cast glares or stares at the humans. He could imagine no reason why the Sill should forgive the humans for bringing all this upon them. But then he was yet again seeing them as thinking like humans, and they did not. The talk continued for a while as Cliff listened intently, trying to judge how Quirt saw the world. Having an alien who had already learned English was an immense advantage, but Quirt's short, punchy sentences gave only a surface view of the mind beneath.
If I were a lizard, I'd be a belt by now, Irma said at one point, and for the first time they saw Quirt laugh.
Or something like it. Barks that could just as well have been a summons, but accompanied by eye blinks and sideways jerks of the head. As Quirt did this, the eyes watched the humans, and there came a moment of... Cliff grasped for the right word. Yes, communion. A meeting of minds. This cheered him up a great deal. Then Quirt said there were meetings to go to, clearly meaning to end on a high, light note. They broke up and returned to the cave-like place the Sill had given over to the humans. It was a rude warren built of rocks rolled together to form corridors and rooms.
A thick tent-like sheet drawn over the top of the whole sprawl of rock made a roof. At certain places, detachable patches let in sun for the rooms and were easily pegged back in place for sleep. Utilitarian and, Cliff realized, quite portable. Just roll up the sheet and find another field of boulders. The sill apparently used whole gangs to move the rocks, a communal effort. The whole team was tired, and somehow the sill dirge had quieted them. They went to their rooms. Cliff took a side corridor to his own small cubbyhole. Irma gave him a smile he could feel in his hip pocket. Cliff had never fancied himself much of a lover, but since they had been taken under the protection of the sill, they were at it every sleep period. This was no exception. They slept a while then, and when he woke up, she was looking at him. With a lazy smile, she said,
"When the chemistry is right, all the experiments work."
"I'm more of a biology type."
"That too. You know, you've learned how to keep this pack of people together, too. I watch you do it. You've learned how to pull their strings."
Yours too?"
"Not so much. Learning to pull men's strings is one of a woman's major skills, of course. I can see you do it in your own guy way."
She softened this, though, with a grin. He felt uneasy thinking about being manipulative, but I learned on the job.
"You let everybody have their say, then let them do the calculation. Who's with them, who's not? Most of the time, that solves the problem."
"Well, they think I have your vote already." She laughed.
"Touché, but not because of fun in the sack."
They were indeed in a sack of sorts. The open, braced hammock fiber somehow stayed flat, though it hung from straps, a smart carbon sheet. He didn't like discussing how to manage their little team, though. He now trusted his intuition and was relieved not to think about it. He leaned over, kissed her. "What do you think we should do next?"
"If you keep caressing my leg, I'll tell you."
Cliff laughed and kept up a smooth, steady stroking of her tawny leg. He hadn't noticed he was doing it. "I don't see how we can find Beth or stay away from the folk, much less figure out this place." Irma shrugged.
"I don't either, yet."
"What makes you think we can?"
"Well, for one thing, it's us. And we have smarts."
"Smarter than what built this contraption?"
"Well, there's street smarts on Earth. Remember that phrase? Means you can get around on your own. Maybe here we have planet smarts."
"Which means?" A pretty obvious way not to give away what he thought, but people didn't seem to notice it.
"This place seems to be deeply conservative. You have to be, to keep a contrivance like this running. Hell, even at first glance, I knew it wasn't stable. If the bowl gets closer to the star, the biosphere heats up and starts to fall toward the star. To correct that, I'd guess the locals have to fire up the jet stronger, propel the star away, and get back to the right distance for heating.
Then there's the problem of what to do if I stamp my foot and the bowl starts to wobble.
It must be they have correction mechanisms in place. On a planet, inertia alone and Newton's laws keep you going if you do nothing. Not here."
"Ah, the spirit of an engineer. You didn't answer my question." She chuckled.
"You noticed. I'd say stay here. Try to get back in touch with Sunseeker. Let Redwing figure a way to help us."
"He doesn't seem to have a clue. Unless you're down here, it's hard to get a grip on the quiet, odd ways this place is so different from a planet."
"Such as?"
"It's impossibly big, but it's mostly vacant."
"Why?" "It suits the folk mentality, must be. Lots of natural landscape. Okay, not natural, but it's shaped to feel natural. It's a park, really. The sill fit in here, too."
"Nomad habits of mind, right? And the bowl is a nomad, too. Wanderers living on a wandering artifact. A big, smart object." She pursed her lips.
"Smart? Because it has to be managed all the time? Kept from falling into its star?"
"It moves forward in a dangerous way, just like us. Any two-legged creature has to fall forward and catch itself. Aside from birds, there aren't many earthside animals that do that. The most common two-legged one is us." She considered this.
"The bird folk are two-legged, in a way. Though I saw them move on all fours, too, since the forearms can help them for stability. Maybe they're concerned about not falling because they're massive."
"So, they have the same gut instinct. Move forward, even if it's tricky. I... Shouting in the distance, Irma got up and pulled on her rather tattered uniform, stuck a head out through the curtain of her chamber.
Quirt? What's...
The alien came into the room, and the quick sliding way the sill made look so liquidly graceful.
Come. They...
Cliff hauled out of the hammock, feeling his joints ache and eyes sticky. His fingers fumbled as he got dressed. Irma went with Quirt. By the time he got to the entrance, they were all staring up at something humming in the sky. Not the balloon creature that had fired on them all, something smaller, faster. It skimmed low, wings purring. A slim winged thing of feathers and a big crusty head that scanned the land below systematically. Its big glittering eyes saw the sill settlement and turned toward them.
Like a huge dragonfly, Irma whispered.
Quirt said,
Scout, smart one, high value, so folk must...
The thing surged as it turned toward them. Cliff said, Inside. The nearest building was ceramic-coated with crusty bronzed metal. He ran toward it as he looked back. Howard was watching with binoculars the slim body as it canted in the air, wings furious.
Howard!
Quirt was faster than the humans and got into the building entrance. It caught the big hinged door and swung it nearly closed as people ran under its arch.
Howard!
Cliff called, and then went in.
We must be inside, Quirt said. Scout smart with...
A humming in the air washed over them. Cliff saw Howard jerk and grab with frenzied fingers at his head. A startled yelp from him turned to a high, shrill scream. Howard fell and was snatching at his legs, head, chest. His jaw yawned wide with a colossal cry. His eyes bulged white. Quirt slammed the heavy metal door closed and drove a latch into place, cutting off Howard's shriek like a knife. Cliff stood blinking at the big door, unable to push away the sharp image of Howard frantically slapping at invisible demons. The humans looked around at the crowds, dazed. There were many Sill already inside, providing a chorus of their sliding speech, feet shuffling, eyes shifting uneasily at this latest attack. Others, though, slumped against walls and let their heads rest back, eyes closed as if resigned to absorbing yet one more disaster.
They get to shelter fast, Irma noted. Seem to be riding it out, pacing themselves.
There were no windows in this place. Phosphors lit the narrow rooms. Cliff went through the sill crowds, their eyes tracking him, and down a corridor, searching for a way to see out. The air hung thick and carried an odd, sour flavor. He turned back and found Quirt following him, who said,
Hurt come through glass.
You come here to get away from the folk microwave weapon?
Quirt made the odd, waggling sign of assent.
They folk change to do your kind.
Irma had followed Quirt through the claustro corridors.
This time it hit Howard. The folk must have found the right frequency or power levels.
Folk know technologies well, adjust fast, always have.
And sent it on that scout?
Cliff wanted to see how Howard was doing. If I could get a look...
No window this place.
Quirt made a hand gesture that they had learned during the long days of burying the Sill dead meant rest peacefully, no cares. The Sill would not let Cliff find a way to look out. One of them came down a chute and, speaking quickly in the sibilant squirts the Sill used, through Quirt, reported that the fast-flying scout with the big gleaming eyes had circled until it tired, fired down randomly at some Sill, then flew away. Irma said,
It's come before?
Only metal stops hurt.
Quirt looked weary, long lines running down its pale face and leathery neck.
Keep tight.
Cliff knew that microwaves in the spectral region that plucked at the human nervous system were about 3 millimeters in wavelength. The Sill must be vulnerable to a different wavelength, since humans had not felt the pain gun used in earlier assaults. So the folk must have developed something that hurt Howard a great deal, and done it within a short while. Something around 100 gigahertz. Impressive. Irma said,
So they must know you, Sill, very well.
The Aquila da Torpa knows us. It look for you.
You've been living a long time with the folk. Under them, I should say. How do you bear it?
Quirt thought a while, and Cliff let him, not interrupting. Humans had a nervous, intrusive way of interrupting each other, a social gaffe of some consequence among the Sill. Then Quirt sighed and said slowly,
"You have word. Enchant means our Ochik, or like it. Enchant comes from light, from sun, and jet. Living essence is enchant. Ochik comes down streaming. Plants, animals, Sill, and now human grow and learn and think from Ochig. Bull turns to keep us here, so Ochig can bring enchant passing through us. Sill in world, human in world, folk more in the Ochig, sick in Ochig. Moving through world, Ochig makes pattern. Folk see pattern, get pattern wrong, and folk do wrong."
"They don't seem any better than you, Sill."
"Not better, but in right place."
"They're in the right place when they slaughter you?"
"Right will come. Ochig endures."
This was the longest Quirt had ever talked about anything, indeed the longest speech he had ever overheard among any of the Sill. They had an air of paying attention to the passing moment. He envied that. Cliff wandered aimlessly, still seeing in his mind's eye Howard slapping at himself and shrieking. He came upon Irma, who had found a little cranny and was sitting on the bare, cold stone floor, sobbing. He sat beside her and took her shoulders in his hands and drew her close. Soon enough he was murmuring and clutching her, letting out emotions he did not wish to name. Just holding her helped. He needed the tight muscles in her neck and shoulders. She did the same for him, and in the long, dim time between them, some comfort stole over their bodies, and then deeper. He could not cry, but she could, letting the soft sobs out one at a time. Time eased around them. They spent more hours inside before the Sill unwrapped the shelter. They coiled up shiny sheets that they had triggered to cover all the door hinges. Intense electromagnetic waves with millimeter wavelengths can leak around slim edges, even those less than a millimeter wide. Cliff looked out a small window and saw Howard curled up on the ground with no Sill within view. They came out a side door and surveyed the empty sky. A.B. rushed forward, unhooking the first aid kit, and they all stopped where Howard sprawled. Howard did not resemble a man now nearly so much as a twisted, red, roasted chicken. Lips blue and bloodless, arms a blotchy purple. His eyes peered up at them, as though asking what had happened. Cliff stared at the face a long time. This man had been under his leadership since they left the ship, since they went through the lock at their landing, and then across long, weary paths and through sudden panics. Howard had a habit of getting hurt, missing jumps and landing wrong, some scrapes and sprains, despite his physical stats. The ground truth, as their training had told them, was the final fact, and no tests or training could tell you what happened when plans met reality in a usually brutal collision. Swift came reality, and it took no prisoners. Cliff had not seen this coming, and Howard had lagged a step or two behind, and so was now forever gone, on his watch. Quirt said quietly,
"Is quick. Hurt is where beam hits."
They buried Howard with the other Sill in the collective gravesite. Cliff said little, and they were walking back from the site when a faint hum filled the air. Heads turned. Sill nearby rustled with alarm. The slim shape skimmed low, wings whirring in the sky. Sill began running. Their yellow eyes raced with jittery panic.
"Go time," Quirt said.
They went.